We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
What's up, y'all? It's Drewski, and I've teamed up with Mountain Dew to produce a hilarious new basketball podcast called The Dew Zone with Drewski. Learn the backstories of your favorite ballers and celebrities like Jamal Murray.
Did you have like a favorite team? Was it the Raptors at the time or no? Was the Raptors even started around that time?
Come on, bro.
I ain't that old, fam. You're talking like I'm 50.
Taylor Rooks, Asia Wilson, and many more. You won't want to miss this. Listen to The Dew Zone with Drewski on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you listen to podcasts.
In the Know, the Bourbon Street Shots Podcast. It's all Pelicans, all the time. And welcome to the show. It's been 2 weeks since our last podcast, and the Pelicans went 4-3 since that time. If we want to feel cooler about ourselves, we could say over the last week, the Pelicans went 3-1. That's much more impressive. And much more reflective of the record, correct?
We do feel cooler about ourselves by saying that, yes. Yeah, this team, for so long, we just wanted to be over 500. We've done it multiple times this season, so this is a totally weird feeling, but I'm here for it.
Right, right. I think all together they've been over 500 on like 7 different days. That's pretty amazing.
Yeah, I mean, there's only... Let's see, there's only one time since November 11th. So for how many days? Looks like for 2 days since November 11th, we have been 500. Every other day, we've been over it. So
yeah,
getting used to this winning feeling.
And honestly, the road trip was supposed to be a pretty dramatic issue for us, and we came through that basically even. And since then, they've been playing a little bit better than 500. Do you think, is that an accurate reflection of this team? Is this team actually a slightly better than average team at this point?
I always thought that if you shut injuries off, this is a 45-49 win team. Injuries haven't been off. They've had a couple. Other teams are probably experiencing more dramatic injuries, and you got to believe that the Boogie, AD, you know, at least 1 to 2 week injuries are coming. But for what this team is when relatively healthy, I think that they are a slightly above 500 team with the potential to be a little better if certain guys catch hot streaks. So, yeah, I think this is a pretty fair reflection.
Good. So which of these 7 games, so we're not going to talk about all of them, was the most impressive, and we know it was the least impressive, the whooping in Denver. What the hell is it with Denver and our New Orleans franchise? Does Denver get all of the just complete beatdowns? It's freaking frustrating. But what was the most impressive? What did you think was the most impressive game?
I'm gonna cop out here, and I'm gonna choose 4 quarters. But it'll be 4 quarters over 2 games. I think the second half of the San Antonio game and then the first half of the Phoenix game was the most impressive four quarters I've seen them play. And it really started with their defense and particularly their perimeter defense. I thought that Jrue Holiday in those two games was unbelievable. Like, the people who give him all the accolades on defense and, you know, want to say, yeah, he's below average on offense, but he's awesome on defense. He really hasn't been. Something has kind of clicked the last couple of games, and even in that first half of the Golden State game. But those four quarters were so impressive to me, and people will talk about the shots that we hit. But it was because it was the first time I felt like the way I see the Spurs when they're really locked in playing defense. Like, I felt like the Pelicans were actually playing defense like that for four or five quarters over those two games. So that's my answer. What's yours?
Honestly, I felt the best about the Oklahoma City game. If I was just picking a game, obviously San Antonio was good, but I did feel a little bit like, you know, Pop is perfectly willing to wave the white flag, you know, earlier than most coaches could get away with. So as far as a full game went, I didn't think that was as good as just the Oklahoma City game. They got down really awful, just like they did the Denver. It triggered me at the beginning of that game, and I was swearing on Twitter. Like, it was awful when your team starts two games like 25-6 or whatever it was. It was just crazy. But the fact that they fought back, they just kept grinding them down and playing a really tough-nosed defense, and then they pulled it out at the very end. That was a fun game, and I recognize that OKC has issues, but can you remember this team in any of the 4 or 5 years previous to this really just putting their nose to the grindstone and grinding out a game that they really had no business winning at when they were down that far? I can't. So
I mean, yeah, it's pretty rare. That one was impressive to me. For the thing that bothered me a little bit about that one is, okay, I bash on the Pelicans and their IQ and the way they play. OKC in that game, it didn't feel like we stopped them as much as they stopped themselves. And, like, I'll give you one example. There was a play where they would keep running, like, the 1-3 pick and roll or 1-4 pick and roll. And then eventually they got Carmelo in the post against Jrue, who's a pretty good post defender. But Carmelo just backed him down and basically just turned around and laid the ball. Like, there was no resistance from Jrue. The Pelicans didn't come to help double or help him out or whatever. And I was like, oh, my God, that was so easy. The Thunder literally never did that again. Like, they are, you hear in football, like, keep running the same play until they stop you. And that's what the good teams do, or they show they could stop it. Like, the Thunder had things that were so obvious that they could have just went to and time again. But they just have, like, this macho bravado. Like, I don't think Carmelo Anthony, if you told him he could have done that all game and scored 45, he would have been like, no, I want to show my crossover pull-up, step back jumper, and they just make the game way too hard for themselves. And I just didn't feel like the Pelicans stopped them as much as they stopped themselves, and that's why I was a little bit more impressed by the San Antonio game.
Sure. So let me just say this, because I think it feeds into what you were saying about the Phoenix and San Antonio. I felt that the moment in the Golden State game where things changed, where Golden State started to really turn it on and the Pelicans weren't able to keep up, was not when DeMarcus Cousins decided he was going to be Captain Doofus. And it wasn't because, you know, our team wasn't able to knock down shots. I felt it was when Jrue went to the bench in the third quarter. Jrue was actually giving Klay Thompson every bit of defense that Klay could handle. And suddenly, like, I felt like Klay was having an okay game, but not a great game. And all of a sudden he just started drilling shots. And I was sort of, why is he getting open all of a sudden? And he realized he's being tracked by Moore or Darius Miller, who have the size but not the speed and athleticism to keep up with him through all those things, all those different screens they run from, all the off-ball cuts, and it was noticeable. And to be fair, it also was Drew went out and Jameer Nelson came in, and Jameer Nelson didn't have a prayer defending any of the people on Golden State. But that's where I felt it really changed. Like, I felt like they could have fought tooth and nail to the end. Probably not still not won, but they would have at least kept it close all the way through until that little spurt happened. So.
Yeah, no, he's had the reputation of a good defender, and he's had spurts, but this is the best defense I've seen him play in a long time. And, you know, I'm sure we'll talk about Rondo, the good and the bad. The one thing that I've really noticed is that since Rondo's gotten back, the team has been talking so much more on defense, and particularly Holiday. Holiday's usually a mild-mannered guy, barely says anything. I'd ask people to watch him on the defensive end and just in general over these next couple games. He's talking so much more than he used to, and I think he's been fantastic on defense these last couple games. So, yeah, the Thunder win was nice because of the way it happened, but I'll say, like, it didn't really trigger any optimism for me. Watching that second half of the Spurs game and then the first half of the Phoenix game, because, yeah, you could say Phoenix sucks, but I went into that game like, oh, here's the ultimate trap game. They just beat the Spurs. They got Golden State tomorrow. You know, Phoenix has beaten some pretty good teams and has been feisty against others. TJ Warren and Booker are two guys who could go up for 35 on any given night. I'm like, oh, here, you know, and games like that, the Pelicans were winning by one against Atlanta a couple weeks ago, or having to go to overtime to beat Chicago. So it's like you could never take these games for granted. And then the Pelicans just come out and stomp on them in the first half. And I just thought such a big part of that was Drew's defense and just the overall perimeter defense. So that was probably the four or five quarters that got me more optimistic than even the Thunder win.
Yeah, I mean, Devin Booker has routinely roasted the Pelicans. He's a young guy, but it seems like every time we've played them, he's been, you know, putting 30 on them, and he went 4 of 13 and missed every three-pointer shot he took, and I don't feel like he was getting open shots and just bricking them. He was under pressure or trying to make something happen in almost every single one of those scenarios. So, and six turnovers for Booker, which I guess shouldn't be that's surprising. He's a young guy trying to do a little bit too much right now. But
and the ones he made came later in garbage time when Drew was on him. Like, he was just – I've seen a lot of Devin Booker. I've never seen anybody defend him as well as Drew did, because Booker has – you know, he could usually shoot over you. If you're long, he could go by you. Drew was able to stop whatever he wanted to do. So, yeah, those four or five quarters to me was the best – collective span that I had seen the Pelicans play so far this year by far.
Yeah.
So
I'll also say that the one major thing I took away from that game is Len, who, you know, went, was it fourth overall or fifth overall? Fifth overall. At one point he is posting up in the fourth quarter against, you know, Omer Asik, and like three times in a row he couldn't get position, and then just threw the ball back out to the perimeter. And eventually he managed to get two shots off against him and scored him. But I mean, if you are so low on the talent poll that Omer Asik, who's been not able to play for a year and a half, can easily drive you out of the preferred position in the post, you're pretty much in the crap house as far as I'm concerned for being a usable NBA player. Like, Asik should not be able to shut you down. You should be able to eat his lunch. So,
yeah, and speaking of eating lunch, Jared Dudley looks like he had been doing a lot of that lately. He was a guy that was in my potential trade targets, and not anymore. He looks good, God. I joked during the game that it looked like Oliver Miller was wearing his jersey. Like, he was rotund. It was he's definitely not a guy that I would target. I mean, I would love to have Tyson Chandler back on this team. I just don't see how he would fit necessarily, but, you know, Monroe got in foul trouble immediately. We barely saw anything from him. Len was a good rebounder, but, you know, pretty much what you described. This is a team that's definitely going to continue to be looking to sell. I just don't know if I'd be interested in any of the guys that they're looking to sell when you consider fit, contract, you know, what you would have to give, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, I can't disagree. I mean, to be fair, Dudley, that was like his first game back from injury. But he's never been exactly svelte. He's always been a bit on the rotund side of things. But yeah, he looked like Shaq, like when Shaq was like 36 and reporting to training camp to get ready to get in shape for the season.
Yeah,
it was pretty bad.
Yeah, there's no way that guy could give you more than Darius is going to give you or even Solomon Hill's going to give you when he returns. So you could scratch him off the trade list. Like I said, Chandler would be the only guy I would have interest in. I just don't know, you know, how you would play him, how he would fit. But just a guy, I mean, he's still trying so hard. He still impacts both ends of the court. He'll get you those tip-out rebounds. But I don't know how they would play him in this offense. So that one would be tough. But yeah, I don't really, nobody really on this team that I'm super, would be super excited to get.
Yeah, and they have been for some time a fan favorite for Twitter trades. So let's talk a little bit about the Toronto game. So, DeMar DeRozan has always low-key terrified me, and I never wanted to admit it because he always plays the wrong way. It feels like, why should I be terrified against a guy who doesn't do the right things? But then he always seems to come in and just make the Pelicans a little bit miserable, and Lowry always grabs his offensive rebounds and you want to beat your head against. I felt like the Pelicans actually did okay on those two guys there, and it was their interior defense against these guys again that kind of let them down. So Boogie and Davis, give me your real take on their interior defense. You can go out there, and RPM will tell you right now that Boogie Cousins is the most impactful defensive player on the Pelicans. And I know everybody who's listening to this has watched enough games and they're smart enough to understand that that cannot possibly be true. But if I told you right now, rank the, you know, power forward center combos in the league defensively, where would you have the Pelicans just be sitting just in general?
Oh man. I would definitely say below average. I don't think terrible, but I would probably say somewhere in the high teens to low 20s. And they both definitely have their strengths, and their strengths are great strengths. I mean, Cousins, if he just gets to play in the paint defensively, he really is quite good. When you bring him out to the perimeter, whether it's to contest a jump shooter or play the pick and roll or stay with a guy off the drive, it gets bad quick. But when he gets to stay in that short space, which he did a lot in the Golden State game, and you saw a lot of blocks and contests, he's not bad. But in today's NBA, he's just not going to be parked down there. AD, the thing that he, you know, to me is still really bad at is just his off-ball defense and awareness, and he's just always standing flat-footed, and you see it more than anything in that Golden State game. There's just always cutters coming and going through, and he's just flat-footed as opposed to moving or keeping his arms up or side to side in order to, you know, kind of take up space and cutting lanes. He just, when you watch him play defense and then you watch guys like Iguodala or Draymond Green play defense, you could really see the difference. Now, he's a great help defender with block shots around the rim. He contests jump shots and probably blocks more jump shots than anybody in the NBA, but he just doesn't have that general awareness when the play isn't happening directly in front of him. And he has to kind of think a step or two ahead. So I'd put those two as a little below average as far as doing everything during the play. But I've also often said that ending a possession is a part of defense. So you throw rebounding in there, and I'd probably put them somewhere around 10 or 12 just because the rebounding is so good, and those two guys do tend to end possessions more often than not.
Yeah. My general take on their defense now is if you put them on ball, they're both better than solid. I think, and Davis in certain respects against a lot of guys is very good. If you just watch a game and you want to focus on them defensively and see where the game really breaks down, and it has to do with the cutters you're talking about and them playing on a string. If any of them ends up at the elbow on defense and somebody makes a move towards the basket, you will not see them really take a step to help. Even Davis, only if he really thinks he's going to get there does he actually make an effort. Otherwise, they're gonna look to their guy, make sure they're kind of sealing him off, and then be ready for a rebound. They're not going to come sliding down and cut anybody off. They're not going to be helping. They're not going to be poking the ball away unless the person is attacking them directly. And you can get by with being good on one-on-one defense and be able to say, hey, I have an average defense or a slightly above average defense. If you want to be a team that is a legitimate difference maker defensively, a team that can say, I have this defense and it's going to carry me further than, anything else, you have to be top three or four. And this team doesn't have that in them. I can't see that. I was hoping that they could have that. And maybe, Solomon Hill coming back. I know you don't think the world of Solomon Hill's defense. I don't think he's the greatest guy on the planet, but I think that as soon as you start loading up and getting rid of obvious holes in a defensive lineup, then it becomes way, way better. Like, I think it's kind of like on a parabolic curve rather than a straight line. As you fill in spots with better than average defenders. But I still don't see this being, the Boston Celtics, who back in 2008, 2009 were not very good offensively. They led the league in turnovers. They were terrible at a lot of things on the offensive end of the ball, but they were just crushing defensively. And I just don't see that in the makeup of this team.
Yeah, I tend to agree. What you said about AD and just off the ball is still my biggest frustration with him defensively. There's just, again, this lack of awareness, or maybe he feels like he has to do too much or he doesn't trust his teammates. I don't know what it is, but it should be better than what it's been so far. The other thing I want to bring up from this Toronto game is, the thing that I noticed from Toronto that still frustrates me about the Pelicans is you look at this game and, Fred VanVleet plays 22 minutes, Siakam 25, Ananobi gives him 14, Poeltl 16. And like, they're known as this veteran team who has these kind of star players that carry them and yada, yada, yada. But DeLon Wright is another one. They also have, four or five young guys that they're developing and giving minutes to, and some of which help them win this game for sure. And you just look at the Pelicans roster, and ironically, Diallo played a lot of minutes in this particular game, but you look at a team like Toronto and it's kind of, they're doing what we never seem to do. I mean, Ananobi's a later first-round pick. Poeltl, they got. He was obviously a higher guy. But VanVleet, I don't even think he was drafted. Siakam was a second-round pick. And they're simultaneously able to win. And play these young guys and develop them. And I just see Diallo wasting away on the bench and really not developing and not getting any of the royal jelly. You look at other guys that the Pelicans took in the second round and then eventually traded. They haven't had a first-round pick in forever, and the one they had, they traded, rightfully so. But that's the other thing I was kind of envious about with Toronto in this game is they've won for a couple years now, but then they also have some young guys that they're developing and able to play while they win. Do you think that the Pelicans will ever get to that point, or do you think it's just basically going to be, their stars, and then they're going to fill in the rest with free agents for a couple million dollars, and we're never really going to see a pipeline of young guys being developed?
I think it's possible that you'll see a pipeline of young guys being developed, but only if the Pelicans reach the point where they're actually winning, 48, 50 wins. Like, as long as the perception is the Pelicans are a bubble team, where the slightest drop-off will push them out of contention for the playoffs, they're going to continue to think, I need veterans, I need those guys now, I'm going to trade whatever my future assets are to be able to get those guys that will keep me in the playoffs and keep me as a relevant team that's going to be the seventh seed or the sixth seed if things are going right. You got to remember the Raptors were actually ready to blow it up at one point. They had a almost handshake deal to send Lowry to the Knicks at one point. Majiri came in and became their GM, he traded Rudy Gay right off the bat, which everybody knows is a good idea, but he traded Rudy Gay right off the bat, got a nice pick for him. He had other deals to send other people out. Somehow he convinced the Knicks that Andre Bargnani was a usable player and got extra draft picks. Like, so basically we need a GM who comes in and convinces people that, one of our less than good guys is actually worth multiple draft picks, and then maybe we'll be okay. I really think this team is in that really awful spot where they're good enough to possibly compete for the playoffs and keep in that conversation, but they're always on the edge of falling out, and unless they feel that stress, and unless they can get away from it and start bringing in young guys and just keeping them to let them develop, it's not going to happen anytime soon.
Yeah. Yeah, and just one guy I want to talk about, and then we'll get into the Warriors game, which I know you have some thoughts on. But just overall, he really has just been playing since we've been away on the pod. He's played 7 games now. He started 6 of them. His minutes are starting to go up and up. What are your overall thoughts on Rajon Rondo so far?
Oh, I thought for some reason I was expecting you to say Darius Miller there.
we know he's MVP candidate. But.
That's true. Right. We don't even talk about Darius Miller. So I do want to say something about Darius Miller just really fast. Nothing has made me happier than seeing Darius Miller earn minutes because Dante Cunningham plays less minutes, and that makes me happy. Wanted to say that. Rondo. So I know you like to talk about how he's had an impact on the defense, and he's definitely out there talking, and he's definitely out there making right plays, which is very nice. I like that on the offensive end. I think he gets his butt burned on one-on-one defense. He's like the inverse of the guys I was just talking about. Like, if you put Rondo one-on-one against most guards, I don't think he's going to be able to stay in front of them particularly well. But I do think that he's going to make the right plays as a help defender more often than not, which probably makes him fine as a defensive player. So I don't. When you get into the playoffs, and that was one of the things I was going to bring up in the Golden State game, when you start playing against smart teams who have a brain and they realize that nothing is better than Rondo taking a three-pointer or a jump shot, he's going to be a real problem offensively too. There's a reason why Golden State just absolutely ignored him. They did not give a damn what he was doing, and they would load up on Boogie with 2 players. Watch any minute of that game when Rondo's on the floor and Cousins is being crushed by 2 people because Rondo draws no attention. but he does make the right passes. He gets guys easy shots. One of my biggest pet peeves about Drew has always been if he's on a drive and kick situation and he swings the ball out to a guy on the perimeter, he never hits them in the numbers. It always hits them in the knees or it hits them at the shoulder. And Rondo is like dead on, unless he's doing one of his fantastic long bounce passes. He's always dead on right where they need to be catching and shooting. So that, as an aesthetic watching of the offense, makes me very happy, especially when the ball is moving and kicking and playing, going around. But that's my general overall Rondo conversation. Like, do you agree with that, or do you think Rondo is more or less impactful?
I'm a big fan, and I think he's pretty impactful, and I totally agree with you. Against Golden State, although I will say he missed a couple of easy layups that he'll make more times than not, that could have made his stat line a little better and had him be, a little more helpful offensively. But yeah, you're totally right. My thing is, this team is never beating Golden State when it matters anyway, so I don't really care. I'm not going to measure him against that. I'm going to measure him in games against Oklahoma City and Minnesota and the teams that are actually in our stratosphere that, you know, the Pelicans have a chance of beating. And I think he's going to help you more than he hurts you. And it's real easy to pick out the deficiency. Like, it's glaringly obvious. And there'll be games where those shots start to fall. I mean, we've seen it from Rondo in the past. He'll have games where all of a sudden he looks like he could shoot. And when he's doing that with everything else that he's doing, it's going to be hard to lose those games. But, yeah, the smart teams are going to sag off. It's going to make it harder for his teammates. I totally get that. But I just think what he brings – is slightly more than what he takes away. And at the end of the day, he's not your superstar. He's a $3 million guy who's just supposed to be another little piece that helps. And I think he's far more valuable than what they're paying him. But yeah, when they play the Golden States, when they probably play San Antonio in a game that matters, they're going to sag way off and make it harder for other people. But I think more games than not, Rondo's going to be a major plus, even though you won't see it in the stats. Where you do tend to see it, though, is in somebody like Drew Holiday's stats. I don't think that it's any coincidence that since Rondo has come back, Holiday's turnovers have plummeted. You know, Holiday will still have games where he shoots well, shoots bad, yada, 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 but he is turning the ball over far less, including two games in a row where Holiday had zero turnovers, only had one against Phoenix. So I think, you know, he helps out in other stat columns that might not be his. But I'm a big fan of Rondo, and I could see where some might call me a hypocrite, but it's something I want to explain is, like, I just said that I could see his deficiencies, but I applaud his strengths. And I bash Boogie, and, you know, admittedly so, and I tend to point out his weaknesses far more than his strengths, which there's more of. But to me, like, I guess I don't fault a guy for having skills that they're not great at. I'm more of a person that I can't stand a guy if his brain is the thing holding him back from being a good basketball player. So that's just a preference of mine, where other people value skills, I value brain or whatever. And I could see how people would be like, why does McNamara love Rondo when he has all these deficiencies and he hates Cousins and he has these deficiencies? But it's just because of my personal preference. I can't stand mentally weak or fragile, or, you know, people who let their brain get in the way of enormous skill. So I just wanted to say that before I get called out for being a hypocrite.
Sure. There was one thing that happened in that Golden State game that I can't figure out at all. I want to know if you even, as far as I can tell, most people didn't even notice it happening. Why on earth did Ian Clark, who had not played a minute of that game, get inserted with 7:40 to go, and he played the rest of the game? I could not figure that. Like, Etuan Moore had a foul, and they pulled him out, and they inserted Ian Clark for him. And he played the rest of the game during the crunch time. And was he supposed to be there for shooting purposes? Like, is replacing Moore with Clark a big difference? Is, like, his knowledge of the team supposed to give them an edge? I couldn't figure out why. Can you tell me what would be going through Gentry's mind to make that decision? I couldn't figure it out.
To me, it's one of those things where you feel like there's a 95% chance you're going to lose the game. And the only way you win it is if you put in somebody who just goes unconscious and gets crazy hot and, you know, could kind of like get the team up and going in that moment. So it's just one of those things where you roll the dice and you hope that maybe Clark is that 5% chance. I don't think it was anything real strategic or thought through the way that you're trying to think through it and look back at numbers and precedents and what they're doing. I think it's just one of those things where it's like, okay, we've played this way the whole game. This is where it's got us. Let's just throw something out there. We're probably going to lose anyway, but maybe this guy just randomly goes nuclear, and then we could win it that way. That would be my guess.
Yeah. Yeah, I didn't even necessarily have a problem with it. It's not like I felt like anybody else was doing a way better job. But like, Etuan Moore was fine. He couldn't handle Klay Thompson, but there aren't too many people who can. And you know, you need a third guard out there. With Cousins having all the foul trouble, so they were running a lot of three guard sets. So you got to play a third one. So why not Clark? I don't have a problem with that. I couldn't figure out why. It's weird to do that when he's been cold all game. It's not part of rotation. You're just like, yeah, let's throw that guy in there. And that was what my problem. I thought that was weird.
Yeah, to me, what just struck me in that game, and it's something that, like, I have a little bit of Golden State fatigue, and I just take them for granted. But sometimes I forget why they are as great as they are. And yes, they're shooting is amazing. Their shot making is unbelievable, and they even, you know, get lucky on top of that at times. But the real reason they're as great as they are is they just put so much length and quickness out on the court that when, you know, I know the Pelicans lost that game in the third quarter. I mean, where they really lost it was the second quarter, but it wasn't. I mean, yeah, Golden State scored 36, but it was because they were getting stops, and it was just because they put so much length out there, and it just seemed like Iguodala was everywhere on the court. There were no passing lanes. There was no ability to, you know, even get any space off of, like, dribble handoffs or anything like that. This team has two of the greatest shooters of all time, and now KD also. But the real reason that they win and they're going to continue to win is just because they have just so much length, and when they really want to get focused, they could just absolutely shut you down and then turn that into the most devastating offense. And it's just, I don't really care about the Golden State games. I know that the Pelicans will never, ever beat that team when it matters. I know the Warriors are going to win several titles over the next couple of years, and the Pelicans will never win one. So I don't really measure the Pelicans by Golden State. I just want them to get out of there without an injury and maybe once every 2 years steal a win. But that franchise and that team is so far superior that, fine, just give me 3 or 4 losses a year and let me try to win 50 of the other 78.
Okay. Yeah, spring question on you.
Spring it.
Who's your favorite Pelican to watch?
So I would say the one who makes me smile the most, I would say this year it's been Rondo.
Okay.
You have one that's different? I know what you're going to say.
Tony Allen.
Yeah, I knew that one.
I honestly love watching him play basketball. Like, the dude gives a crap, and he works so damn hard, and he makes some of the dumbest decisions on the planet.
Yeah.
But you still, it's like he's doing them. They're almost the right play. He's just terrible at it. So I can't be like mad at him saying you shouldn't try to take a layup there, because any normal offensive player should take a layup there. There's just something about him I just enjoy, and I just feel like he does create a general positive, an overall positive when he's on the floor, even when he's doing this stupid crap. I love the perversity of Tony Allen. It's awesome.
I love him in games, in blowout games, in games that are close. I think you're talking about just offense. I think he makes some really dumb. He makes at least two really dumb defensive plays a game.
So I agree 100%. But also just watch him go over a pick, tracking a guy. The guy is a master. He Zaza Pachulia is an amazing pick setter. He also offensively fouls almost every person he touches at all times. And Tony Allen treated him like he wasn't even there half the time. He's great. I love it. But I don't know. It's really stupid that I picked him of all the people I could pick on this team. Tony Allen being the one is kind of silly, but.
Yeah, oh, I knew it. The second you asked the question, who your favorite? And, in the Phoenix game, Tony Allen had me smiling nonstop. Because the Pelicans were winning that game. It was a blowout.
He went between his legs at one point, crossing a guy over. Oh,
yeah, no, that was hilarious. But in a close game, I don't know how much I trust him on either end. So... yeah, I mean, he's fun, but he commits some really dumb fouls. And you're right in getting through a screen. I will say, though, in that Warriors game, he got lost when trying to trail Clay through some, cross courts. He tries to go through people and take shortcuts just because he's a little older. So even though he's still a great defender in most areas, there's some parts where he takes such low percentage risks that I don't understand it. But yeah, he's been fun.
Okay, so it's been hanging over the podcast the whole time. I'm going to bring it up before we move on to new games coming up. I got to ask you the question, Boogie Cousins. You are obviously quite disdainful for some of the stuff he does. He did not show a particular advantage in the Golden State Warriors game, obviously. If you were the GM of this team, would you be looking to trade Boogie Cousins right now? And take into account everything, including his relationship with Davis, because I think it's an easy cop-out to say something like, I'd go get Gasol, because Gasol's talent is better. Like, fine. But take everything into account when you say that.
Yeah, I would. Of course, it would depend on the return. I wouldn't dump him, or I wouldn't trade him for a pick that might be a good player in 4 years. Like my threshold of what I would get back, if I could get Porter and Marcus Morris, I would do that in a heartbeat. Otto Porter, obviously. So it would depend on what I would get back. The relationship with AD thing, AD's not blind. AD sees that Boogie's a petulant child, and, I'm sure he likes the guy off the court, and a lot of people do, but my main job as a GM is not to build a freaking friendship club. It's to help the team win, and if you put guys around AD that help him win, that's going to make him stay more than him being with a guy who he likes slightly more than another guy, but he's losing anyway. So I don't really take that into account as much. I guess my main thing is I would just be saying, one, what's my goal? Like, I've said this, I don't know how many times on the podcast, this franchise will never win a title. It won't. People need to take that off the table. The ceiling for this franchise is like what the Clippers and Toronto have been the last couple of years. So, okay, that's what I'm aiming for. And then the second part of it is, do I want to win and get there by playing basketball the way I want to play it? Or am I fine just doing it with sheer talent? And like the example I'll give is, so like you had the George Karl, Denver team that won like 56 game or whatever a couple years back. And they just had a bunch of pieces that played hard, played well together and, you know, probably were greater than the sum of their parts. And then you had the Oklahoma City teams who, you know, just through sheer talent of having KD and Russ on the same team, they won and they never really had a system. Those guys just played ISO. Coaches tried to put in a system and, you know, when it came down to it, KD or Russ said, no, we're not running plays. We're just taking over. Would you be okay with that if it led to good results? I'm just more of a basketball purist, and I want to play the game the right way more than I want to just win based off of sheer talent. So that's why, for me, I would trade Boogie if the return was right, because I think the Pelicans will win. They have the sheer talent to impose their will and win. Because AD and Boogie are incredibly talented, I don't think they'll ever play the quote-unquote right way. Like, I know their coaching staff wants to play a different way and wants to, and they're basically just throwing their hands up, especially in the Boogie-centric lineups. And, if anybody thinks that the coaching staff is asking him to do what he's doing, you're absolutely insane. But at some point, it's a stars league, as we saw in Memphis today. Coach and star feud, or the star is not happy with the coach, guess who leaves? So you gotta kind of succumb to your stars, especially when you have so little talent. And the Pelicans will win through sheer talent, but I don't enjoy that at all. I'd rather them win with system and playing the quote unquote right way. So that's why I would do it, as crazy as that probably makes me. That's my long rant on what I would personally do.
I wouldn't trade him.
So, I mean, obviously you would trade him for Kevin Durant and Stephen Curry.
Yeah.
So you can't say you wouldn't trade him, but I mean, you're saying that your bar for trading him would be much, much higher than mine.
That's correct. Yeah, and so like, there's some weird things going on here with Boogie, and again, Boogie doesn't have the temperament to ever be a legitimate all game long positive for your team. Like, there's just too many times where his head's out of it, and he's thinking about how he's been done wrong more than how he's playing the game. And as soon as he starts going into that place, it takes a little bit of time for him to get out of it, if he ever gets out of it. Unless if Draymond Green is there talking to him, he never gets out of it. He's stuck there. But like, the problem I have with this is Boogie's actually really good in the offense. When they put the right players out there and he's trusting his teammates and Rondo is running and chirping at him and Davis is cutting in all the right ways and they're executing plays, like, Boogie looks really good in this role. Boogie looks terrible when they try to put him into a traditional big man. And again, no person in the NBA, I just don't understand this, should be like trying to run a traditional big man post-up anymore. It's just too easy to defend. Watch any game over the last 2 weeks, and when Boogie goes into the post, unless it's against really limited, backups. There's a second guy hovering inches away from him at all times. That's why he's got this huge spike of turnovers. He looks at the he surveys the floor. He realizes if I make a dribble, that guy's going to crash down on me. So I'm going to pick a lazy pass out of here because it's not an easy one, and then it gets picked off. Or he tries to force it in anyways. A guy digs. He's done. Like that. It happens all the time. So what you just want to do in that situation is, if you know Boogie is capable of being a really good offensive force, you're not going to get somebody who's going to be better easily in that role. Just slowly wean him towards one way. Leave him like there are players in the league that they know they were really bad at certain things, but they would just give him three or four of that play because that person liked them. Get him in the right state of mind, and then let him do the proper stuff on the floor. And if you can slowly wean it away so that Boogie, is instead of getting 12 of those plays a game, gets 8 of those plays a game, I think your offense just slowly edges towards really good. And I think that's the route you have to go.
Yeah, I mean, it would be hard to get his talent. And I understand how seductive talent is, especially for a franchise that rarely has it. And then when they do have it, the talent rarely wants to stay here. So especially if Boogie wanted to stay for 4 or 5 more years, like that would be music to a fan base's ears that such a talent wants to stay with the team. I'll admit that a lot of my feelings lately have been skewed by stuff that has come from within the organization, particularly of how they thought they were going to run this team in the off season versus what they've kind of settled into now. Like you say a lot of the things about the putting him in the wrong position, and maybe that's true, but it's also kind of been told that Boogie is desiring to stat stuff, and he wants accolades this season. He wants all-star appearances. He wants to make all NBA teams. And when he's on that second unit by himself, it's just a chance for him in his eyes to put up as many numbers as possible. And I think stuff like that is just, like I say, he's a talented guy, and we're all a little bit selfish in life. I get it. We all have aversions to certain type of players. The guys who whine, you know, they're in that Phoenix game. Watch any commercial break in that Phoenix game. The team's up by 30 the whole game. All you'll see Boogie doing during timeouts is chirping at the officials and whining the whole time. Like, there's just certain things that get under people's skins, and I'm not perfect, and I'm not the perfect evaluator. The way to get under my skin is being mentally soft or fragile, or being a whiner, complainer, you know, slow to get back on defense. Like, he just basically checks every single box to the point where when he puts up a 40-20 game, I'll be the guy noticing the 5 times he didn't get back on defense, or that he was whining to the official. Or in this past week, we saw him pick up 2 technical fouls at the end of games that were already settled. It's just I don't know, like, maybe it's because I used to be a teacher and I worked with children for so long, I can't stand kids, and that's why I don't have any of my own. And he's just a big kid. He's just a big 10-year-old child with a lot of talent. So, you know, he does plenty of things well, and you guys could all talk about him. We all have particular things we don't like, and he literally checks off every one of my boxes. So I'll root for him to do well as long as he's on the team, but I will never, ever, ever be a fan. And yes, if I was the GM, I would trade him with the quickness. The other thing I'll bring up basketball-wise, though, Ryan, is, haven't you noticed, and the stats bear it out, that AD and 4 perimeter players is infinitely better than Cousins and 4? And therefore, you know, if you moved Boogie, I mean, AD is better with other guys. I mean, lately 80 lineups with four perimeter guys is better than 80 boogie and three perimeter guy lineups. So forget everything I said about personality. Couldn't you make a basketball argument that something like Porter and Morris or, you know, whatever, more perimeter players could yield a better actual basketball team?
Yes, you could absolutely make that case, and I think you'd probably be accurate. I just also don't think that it's a reasonable thing to ask Davis to play center. I don't. I really think that having him play 10 minutes a game at center is pretty much all you should be asking him to do. So,
yeah, so if you look up and down the Western Conference, so look at the other seven teams that are likely to make the playoffs. I only see one team. So, like, let's say you get Morris, for instance, and your new starting front court is Porter, Morris, and Davis. I mean, you just put Morris on every quote-unquote center. You look in Minnesota, watch anybody play Karl Anthony Towns. Nobody is defending him with a center anyway. They're all just defending him with fours or stretch fours or whatever, because he just hangs out on the perimeter all the time. You could put Morris on Zaza Pachulia. Heck, against Denver, Davis started off on Jokic anyway, and they put Cousins on Millsap to start that game. So who are you so worried about Davis banging bodies with, or even somebody like Marcus Morris covering the quote-unquote centers, and that person's going to kill you? So I don't know if I buy that one as much, because who are we talking about AD covering at the five that's going to bang him around that, you know, somebody like Morris can't?
So here's what I would just say in general. You can go down the list to say this guy's not scary, this guy's not scary, this guy's not scary. But you put somebody next to Davis who is undersized, who isn't going to be able to get into the scrum and really fight. That means Davis has to carry more of that load. Like, and I know Marcus Morris is a mean guy. The guy will get in there and scrounge with people. But Davis is going to have to shoulder more of the wrestling load. He's going to have to fight more people down low if you're not giving him another big man who can wrestle at least with some of those people and bend them. Davis is going to have to do that heavy lifting. I think that's a real mistake just based on his past. Just in general. I think any team that ends up trying to play him at center is just setting themselves up for shoulder injuries.
Okay, well, I think it's kind of a moot point. They're not trading Cousins anyway. I was just asked if I would do it. Of course I would. So here's my last thing then, is Cousins is going to be here. It is what it is. We've seen the AD lineups without Cousins have been good to very good. The part that's holding this team down is the Cousins lineups without AD. So you have this roster now. You also have some assets in a trade market. What would you be looking to develop, or what kind of units do you think would be good with Cousins and no AD? What guys on this team would you be putting with them? And then if you went out to trade to add somebody else, what kind of thing that would you be looking for that you think you could make up a Cousins with no AD lineup that at least could be a zero net rating? It's not going to be a negative or a positive, but we would kill for a zero net rating Cousins unit at this point.
So let's put it this way. I can't name players, but when Cousins shifts from the low block to the high block is when he becomes a better offensive threat to me. And right now what he's doing is he's going out there, they're just putting a bunch of shooters around him, and they say, go in the low post, or you want to go in the low post, so go there, whatever the conversation might be. He goes into the low post, and then he surveys the land. He decides whether he's going to make a play. He decides whether he's going to pass the ball out. And, you know, those tend to end up in failures. What you got to do with a mentality like that is figure out how you can shift him to the high post with a second unit and have players around him that aren't going to threaten the I have the ball in my hand mentality. You want him to be making plays out of the high post, scoring and driving and attacking, or passing from that spot rather than the low post, because that gives you more options and more cutters. So you need guys who are going to be willing cutters. You need guys who can get him the ball there. You need guys who can actually, you know, a big man who he can actually have a scenario where he hits them at the dunker spot. That is the kind of roles I think you need to put together so you can try to push him out into that spot and have him be more successful in the second unit.
So, I mean, when you're talking about a big, are you talking about a big that's like a legitimate center? So,
yes.
So you'd be talking about like a
Rolo.
Okay, so Robin Lopez, but I feel like Robin Lopez is he's a better mid-range scorer. I mean, I'm thinking like a what I thought you were describing was like a Willie Cauley-Stein, who so, actually played pretty well with.
So I want to say Willie Cauley-Stein, but there's so much about Willie Cauley-Stein I don't like that I don't want to go to that. But yes, so somebody who can hover around the rim. Pull a big man a little bit away from the rim because you have to worry about that guy sliding to dunk or getting into position for easy offensive rebounds. And Boogie is good enough of a passer that he can drive on two steps and then drop the ball off to somebody. He can do that. So Diallo, if he was stronger and better, like that would be a perfectly fine person in that role. Somebody along those lines I think would help out tremendously, and then you just need them to buy in that we want to have the ball in your hands. We want you attacking, but we want you here at the elbow rather than down low surveying and passing out to 3-point shooters.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, I tend to agree. I think it's got to be another big. Also, I would put Jameer and Drew with him on that second unit, and then the third guy could be Miller, it could be Moore, it could be Hill when he comes back, whatever. But then I would put another big with him as well in that kind of dunker spot, also to get offensive rebounds and also, you know, to help on the defensive end as well. I personally think that's got to be the number one question you're asking yourself. When you hit this trade market is, you know, I basically think that the Pelicans have their starting five and their finishing five. It's hard for me to imagine that they're going to trade for a guy who cracks either of those two. And again, I'm assuming Hill comes back and, you know, maybe he'll crack it on a hot night, but I think that they have their starting five and their finishing five. What I would be looking for is who is a guy that is going to make the Boogie units without AD better, because that's going to be the one time span in almost every game where the Pelicans are vulnerable. And now if all of a sudden you could clean that up and get that back to even just being a net neutral unit, this team could be a very good team. So I think that's the question that's got to be answered moving forward is how do you get those Boogie without AD units to perform much better?
Yep. Before we talk about the next games, I did want to bring up one thing. I saw they only did it once that I've seen. Maybe I missed a play here or there where he didn't get the ball or something. But they did run a elevator door play for Darius Miller. And just seeing that they have that kind of confidence in him makes me extremely happy. And just so if you guys don't know what the elevator door play is, basically you do a bunch of off ball on one side screens and you get Darius Miller running and he crosses the court and the two bigs that are on the other side are standing there in like what looks like a staggered pick, and usually you run to the outside and then run towards the basket around both of them, but instead you dart between them and both of those guys step inwards like a closing elevator door, and Darius, the person, then stops, catches the ball and takes an open shot. The fact that they basically run an entire play just to get an open shot for Darius Miller makes me pretty happy for the guy.
Yeah, I'm glad with how well he's playing, how much confidence he has. I will say that he has one of the oddest, I think a lot of people notice that his shot is flat. The other commonality with all the shots that he makes is that he lands closer to the basket every single time than when he shoots it. As a shooter, you're taught that you want to land, you know, right where you jumped from. And Miller is so much more successful when he's leaning into his shot and jumping forward, which, you know, it kind of reduces some of the screens and off-ball stuff you could run from him, because if he's falling away from the basket, he's not that good. But it's just such an odd shot. But any time that he's squared up and his momentum is going towards the basket when he shoots, I honestly feel like it's going in at this point.
Yeah, it's good. Okay, next three games, Minnesota, Utah, Portland. That's not an easy slate. It's not a terrible slate either. It is Wednesday night at home versus Minnesota, and then they go on a quick two-game road trip December 1st and 2nd, Friday, Saturday, at Utah, at Portland. There could would you say those are the two roughest places in the NBA to play a game? They got probably the best two home courts in the league.
I would say OKC and Portland, but
okay.
Yeah, Utah's pretty good. The crowd this year has kind of been a little bit out of it just because I mean, they've been devastated. Basically, they lost Hayward and Gobert in a matter of just a couple of months. But I'm glad the game's kind of fell in the order, but. Yeah, this isn't easy, but these are the teams that you're competing with for playoff positioning and for getting in the playoffs in the first week. So I think this is really a week that's going to tell us a lot about the Pelicans and kind of where they stand at this point in the Western Conference hierarchy. And I like this Minnesota matchup. If I look back at all the losses throughout the season, I think the Minnesota loss is the one that kind of bugs me the most, is the one that I really think that they could have and should have walked away with, you know, and I'd be hoping that they could kind of remedy that in this game.
Let's talk about the Timberwolves then. What is your take on the Timberwolves? They're 12-8. They actually have a negative point differential. And, you know, it's... Is it a mirage that they're 12-8? Are they actually just, you know, an ordinary team? Did they just get lucky in a couple games, like when they banked in that three pointer against the Oklahoma City Thunder to steal a win? What is your take? If you were ranking them, are they just a middle of the road team? Or are they, you know, an actual playoff team that's probably no chance of missing it?
I think they're a team that's completely dependent on the matchups right in front of them. I don't think that they're a lock playoff team, maybe now because of all the injuries that happen. But offensively, they have just enough firepower to be in any game. Like, it's going to be hard to blow them out, because you would have to think that at least one of their guys is going to have a very good game and the other one's going to be solid. Like, you're not going to have games where two or three of those guys are all completely off that night. So they're going to have enough firepower to stay in any game. And honestly, they do a lot of the things that I wish this Pelicans team would do. Like, if you look at their biggest strengths of a team by far, it's that they don't turn it over. We turn it over a ton. They crash the offensive glass. I mean, you have Taj and Karl Anthony Towns. Like, they're getting almost 6 offensive rebounds a game. And, you know, Zhang comes in with another 2 in limited minutes.
Yeah, they're third in the league in offensive rebound rate. Yeah.
Yeah, and then they get to the free throw line. Like, they don't have anybody who's as high volume as Davis, but they just have a ton, all their rotation players on their team find a way to get to the line. And it's just those things where they're not a great shooting team. You know, they don't have a ton of creativity on their offense, but they're not going to turn it over. When they miss, a fourth of the time they're going to get the offensive rebound, and then they're going to get to the line, which is going to put you in the penalty, which is going to get your guys in foul trouble. Like, they're doing things that I wish the Pelicans would do more of, because they have the personnel to do it. So they're going to be in almost every game, and then, you know, at that point it's just a toss up, but they've been winning more of those toss ups than they've been losing so far.
Yeah. Any chance that the Pelicans hold Karl Anthony Towns to 2 points again?
No, but I think AD will clearly win that matchup. I also think that the perimeter defense will be better suited this time. I mean, Wiggins or Butler didn't go off, but they hit some big shots. I thought what killed the Pelicans in that last game was the weakness of this Minnesota team is their bench, and their bench just kicked our bench's ass.
Yeah, murdered them.
Yeah, that cannot happen again. I mean, it shouldn't happen again. I mean, Bielisa's, you know, he's having a very good year, and he's a guy that's, I mean, to me, he's kind of like Mirotic-like when Mirotic is on, that kind of player. But there should be nobody else on that second unit that really scares you. And the Pelicans lost that game plain and simple because the Minnesota bench, even though Minnesota was on the road, kicked the Pelicans bench's ass, and that can't happen again.
Yep. Yep. All right. So, any worry that Jimmy Butler is going to finally go off?
I mean, there's always a worry, especially when the Pelicans don't have great, great wing defense. But I think they got enough guys to throw at him. So, no, and the Pelicans will actually be getting Minnesota on the second night of a back-to-back. And the Pelicans will have had, God, what, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, so 3 days of rest going into this game. So they'll definitely have the rest advantage. So this is a game where if you really are a playoff team in the West, you win this game at home and move on to Utah.
Okay. So then we'll just talk about all three of these teams. So Utah, have you gone to, I mean, you're there. Have you gone to any of their games this season?
Yeah, I've been to one, and they play a very boring brand of basketball, and it, you know, it was fine until Gobert got hurt. And then them just trying to play that same style without having, I mean, everybody knows him for his defense, but he really was, teams are scared of him offensively, his rim running, and then his ability to get position on offensive rebounds. Like, he really was somebody that teams really respected offensively. Now Utah's basically reduced to a, if Rodney Hood is on, we have a chance to win. If he's off, we have a 0% chance of winning this game, regardless of what team we're playing. So to me, the number one thing you have to do in this game is know every minute that Rodney Hood is on the court, where he is, and basically shut him down the way you did Devin Booker. If you do that, there's no way, like, if Rodney Hood has an off game, this Utah team can't even score 90 points. Like, they, no chance. So, I think that's got to be the priority in this game.
What happened to Derek Favors?
I don't know. They've just put him in so many different roles. And, I mean, at some point, he was their low post guy. And like you said, this league just knows how to defend low post players. Now, he was never great defensively. He was just okay, but he just never developed that mid-range and definitely not a three-point shot. So he's just kind of stuck to where if this was 1994, he'd be a very good player, but it's just not that time in the league anymore.
Okay. He always felt like he was on the verge of maybe figuring something out, and he just never did. And yeah, he struggled with injuries too a lot. But okay, so the last team we get to talk about is Portland, who, you know, I guess they're fourth in the West right now, 13-8. They have the third best point differential in the Western Conference at plus 4.4. Now, a part of that, they're still still reaping the rewards of absolutely blitzing the Phoenix Suns 124-76 early in the season. That's still skewing their numbers a bit, but there's better than I thought they were going to be. Do you feel the same way about them? Are you surprised that they actually have a decent defense? And do you think that's because of Nurkic, or do you think that's because of other reasons?
I think that they're basically a super Allen Iverson Philadelphia 76ers team where they have these two guards, and then they're just telling everybody else to hustle their butts off, play defense, and rebound, and they have the stamina to do that because the other guys are carrying such a big offensive load. But, man, this team, I think this team just pisses me off because they have a lucky horseshoe up their butt. Like, how do Lillard and – because if Lillard and McCollum ever get hurt, this team just spirals the same way that Memphis is right now or Utah is, et cetera. But those guys just never get hurt. They play 80 games every freaking year. Like, how does this happen? Like, how do you continue to get that lucky? So, no, I'm not surprised because I think this is about what this team is when those guys are healthy. But I don't understand, like, how they get lucky enough to have their guys just healthy every year. I guess it's the injury gods paying them back for Brandon Roy and Greg Oden. So, I guess I can't be too upset. But, yeah, this is what this team should be if they're healthy. I'm just waiting for Lillard and McCollum to go down, and then we'll see them for who they really are.
Yeah. Although right now they're starting Caleb Swanigan. So that's probably not the best thing in the world for them.
Yeah, I mean, again, where this team – I mean, this is obviously the game that AD got hurt, and you have to believe that if AD stays in, Pelicans could have won that game. The thing, though, that this team does incredibly well that they killed us in that game was just crashing the glass. Another team that's rebounding 25% of their misses. So, yeah, some good defensive numbers. I don't think they're as good as their numbers indicate. But the one thing I do think that they're really good at, they're top five in both defensive rebound percentage and offensive rebound percentage. So this is going to have to be a game where it's got to be more than AD and Boogie. The guards are going to have to come down and crash and help clean up some rebounds. So I think that's going to be the key to this game.
They've been better at it. So, I mean, it's something that with Rondo, honestly, coming back, I think that's probably one of the bigger things I've noticed is at least one or two guys is coming and helping the bigs rebound a little more than they were before. And I'm sure it's because Rondo wants to grab the ball and go up court, but it helps, right?
Yeah, to me, the lineups where AD and Boogie are both on, I think they'll be fine. It's when one of those guys is off the court in this game. I mean, if you...
And Ed Davis comes on and murders us for 10 right. minutes straight.
Yeah, like the lineups we saw in the last couple of games, like Darius Miller was the power forward. That just... unless you are planning to outscore Portland in those minutes, that's just not going to work because they're just going to eat you alive on the glass.
All right, so prediction time. At home versus Minnesota, on the road, Utah, back-to-back second night in Portland. And then, can you believe it, the Monday after they have to play at, Golden State at home. Like, anyways. what is your prediction for those three games, ignoring the Golden State?
I'm going to go with a 2-1 week. I got the Jazz game as a definite win, and then the Minnesota game 60-40, the Portland game's 40-60, so it evens out. They'll win one of those two games. I'm not 100% sure which one, but 2-1 overall.
Yeah, I'm going to go 2-1. I want to be stupid and say 3-0, but I'll control my stupid for once. For once. So, got anything else to talk about?
Oh, no, that's about it. It looks like, the schedule after this week, nothing incredibly easy, nothing incredibly hard, just a lot of teams that will kind of show the Pelicans who they are, so it'll be interesting. And then on December 15th, the trade market opens up a little bit more, so Pelicans are approaching that, and it'll be curious to see which way they go to either add a player or if they just stand pat.
Yeah. All right. Thanks, everybody, for listening to In the Know.
Nobody builds 5G like Verizon builds 5G, because we're the engineers who built the most reliable network in America. And the more you do with 5G, the more building it right matters. The more your network matters. The more Verizon engineers going the extra mile matters. It's us pushing us. It's Verizon versus Verizon. 5G built right from America's most reliable network. Most reliable based on rankings from RootMetrics second half 2020 U.S. report of 3 mobile networks. Results may vary. Award is not an endorsement.